This is an interview for the SEC Historical Society's Virtual Museum and Archive of the History of Financial Regulation. I'm William Thomas. I'm talking with Martin Liebecker, and the date is May 3rd, 2016, and we are in Washington, D.C. So thanks very much for agreeing to speak with us today. We usually start with a little bit of personal background. I see that you were born in Nebraska. Did you grow up there as well?
No. My father was in the military, so that's where he was stationed near the end of World War II. So I'm a baby boomer. That's just where I was born. Both my mother and my father grew up in Washington State, Eastern Washington State, to be specific.
Okay, and then you went, I saw you did your undergraduate there in Washington.
We moved around Washington State and finally settled in Seattle. So most of my childhood was spent in Seattle and graduated from high school, college, and law school in Seattle.
Okay, so you studied, it was accounting and history at Washington?
Yes.
Okay. And then you, as you said, you did law school there as well. What got you into law?
I'm not one of those people who wanted to be Perry Mason, but I like the idea of a professional job, and accounting is sort of one way to do that, and the mm-hmm. law was the other. And at the University of Washington, all undergraduates were allowed to go study in the law school library, and it was by far the nicest place to study in the entire university. So you kind of got used to being there and hearing people talk. It was on the quad, too. It's one of the oldest buildings. So it just felt very comfortable.
Okay. And then did you have any aspirations for what you wanted to do? I see that you then went on to do further legal education at the University of Pennsylvania.
I knew that I wanted to be a business lawyer. And when in the fall of the year that I would have graduated from law school, Boeing lost the SST. There were no fish in Alaska. And Weyerhaeuser couldn't sell timber even to the Japanese, as a local story went. So there were literally no jobs in Seattle. And when you graduated, the local catchment area for people with JDs from the University of Washington was Seattle and the greater Pacific Northwest. There just weren't any jobs. So my tax professor talked me into going to NYU for a year, and I got an LLM in tax. And my business planning professor and securities law professor talked me into going to Penn for a second LLM, which I got with Bob Mundheim, who was then one of the senior reigning securities professors in the country. And it was he who talked me into going to the SEC at the end of those 2 years. So I basically did, as my father would think about it, I did 7 years of higher education. No, 9 years of higher education before I figured out what I wanted to do when I grew up.
So were you steering in any particular direction through your LLMs, or were you being steered?
I like being a securities lawyer, and yeah. I like being a business lawyer. Between the accounting, tax, and security stuff at Penn, I was very well, had a great background for it. And it seemed a lot of people had done a period of time at the SEC, and it seemed, mm-hmm. That the public interest certainly wouldn't hurt and would be a good thing for one's career. It also was a very exciting time to be in 72, 73. It was a very exciting time to think about being at the SEC. Life was changing dramatically, and when those things happen, it's always sort of fun to be at a place when stuff is going to happen.
And so you got a job then straight away in the office of the chief counsel in the IM division?
Yes.
Okay. Tell me how that came about and what that job was all about.
Bob Mundheim helped with the introductions to the senior people in the division, and I was hired to be in Alan Rosenblatt's office. And the way work was divided then, we got all the rules, we got the no action letters, and we got the legislation. So it was, other than the exemptive applications, it was sort of everything that was fun that the division was doing that was challenging.
Mm-hmm. So did you have any particular responsibilities with respect to your position versus what other people in the office would have been doing?
I think Alan Rosenblatt had 3 or 4 people in his office, and we shared all of those things. There wasn't anything that was particularly specific to me. I did work with Alan to create the division's library. Prior to that time, there wasn't anything that was a formal collection spot, and we hired a person from one of the record-keeping branches at the SEC and turned her into our librarian and captured everything that was going on in the division so that one copy of everything ended up being in the library so you could go find things. And at the same time, as you know, Louis Loss was at the beginning end of doing his ALI securities code, and he had decided that he didn't want to try and take on any of the 40 Act questions because he thought they were too hard and it would be too disruptive or controversial. So we had a lot of things we wanted to get fixed, and he would have been a perfect vehicle for doing that. So Alan gave me the assignment of writing a law review article, which was subsequently published in Penn in 1976, where for 100 pages, we tried to answer every single question that was, every single problem that was screwed up on the 40 Act in some way or another, whether it was history, whether it was a thoughtlessness of a gap, or whether it had been misapplied by a court or whatever. And it meant that I, with the library right next to me, I got to spend a lot of my time, half a day every day for a long time, just going through historical files. So I read the original files on the rulemaking on Rule 17D1, all the Section 17 rules. At one point, I read every single Advisors Act release. What a wonderful chance to go just relive history all over again. And these were the, you know, in those days, there was a thing called a ribbon copy, where you could see where the typewriter actually smashed into the paper. And what you were looking at was the smashed version. And so you could see initials and everything. It was very interesting.
That's very nice. Were there any particular areas that you focused on in that review of the 40 Act?
There were things that were on the division's list of things to fix. So the district court decision, the Fifth Avenue Coach Lines, had decided that some kinds of CDs were cash and therefore not securities. And it would have made the application of Section 17 to Roy Cohen's mistreatment of Fifth Avenue Coach Lines would have made it outside the ambit of the 40 Act. So we wanted to fix things like that, make the opposite argument, take the position, and try and get Louis Loss to fix it.
Was there any interaction with Louis Loss and that project?
He had a sort of personal conflict in that he was counsel to the American Council of Life Insurance on securities insurance questions. And so because that means variable annuities and variable life, he was kind of uncomfortable dealing with the 40 Act. So instead, he assigned Victor Brudney to us, who turned out to be a charming person, but also very sympathetic to everything we wanted to fix, and could actually be a gateway to Louis in a very positive way. So we spent a lot of time corresponding with Victor. It was fun.
So, of course, the ALI Securities Code project ultimately did not go through. So what was kind of the history of your own work with that? Were there prospects that there would be reforms on that on the basis of it?
Yes. I'm looking over at your shoulder. You can see the two volumes right there on your left in every tentative draft, and I still look at them. I couldn't say every day, but it's at least once every couple of weeks, because what he captured was every anomaly in all of the policy arguments behind every section. So if you're trying to figure out why beneficial ownership means one thing in Section 13, but it means another thing in Section 2A9, you can actually, using his book, you could at least probe what he thought it was about. And he points out a lot of the sort of nobody can figure it out anomalies. There were so many changes and so much change that the powers that be in the American Law Institute got it published, but it was pretty clear that the securities bar was not eager to have it passed. Mm-hmm. So probably very disappointingly to Louis Loss, who only lived for another 4 or 5 years, it was never even introduced as a bill. It's just an object on people's bookshelves.
So I know that it wasn't too long before you also ended up doing some academic work as well.
I left the SEC in June of 1975 and became a full-time law teacher, fully expecting to be that for the rest of my life. Mm-hmm. While I was at the University of Washington, I'd been a part-time accounting teacher while being a law student, which is sort of interesting, having an appointment in another department and being a student in another department, but that's what I did. So the idea of being a teacher was very comfortable for me, and the situation in Seattle, just in terms of thinking about going home, hadn't really changed. The economy hadn't turned around from 1969 much, so law firms that hadn't been hiring still weren't hiring. So academia seemed like a better place. I looked all around the country, ended up going to State University of New York at Buffalo, was there for 2 years, and then taught 1 year full-time at Duke at the same time I had a co-appointment at UNC.
Wanted to do that all along, or had this project that you were working on at the SEC kind of pushed you in that direction, all the research involved?
Teaching was very comfortable. I'm very comfortable in a classroom. I'm very comfortable in a teaching mode. And most of the people who bumped into me in life would say that probably was my natural instincts are to be a teacher. It's certainly, from a sports standpoint, my natural instincts are to be a coach, as my father was. So having gone through the SEC as sort of a quasi-academic, it was very comfortable to be a teacher about the same things.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about the investment management area at that time. So the first thing, of course, you have the 40 Act and you have the Advisors Act. And I know that the Advisors Act is there wasn't as much activity in that area. So maybe we should just deal with that first and talk about what the status of it was at the time.
It really was the stepchild from a division standpoint. The rap on it from the beginning was it was just intended to be a survey, just a way of registering to make sure you knew exactly how many people there were, because there was virtually no rules under Section 206. Early on, if memory serves, it's 1972 or 1973, the SEC won a case against Citibank, the so-called mini-account case, that took the position that if a person sold an interest in what purported to be a separate account, but in fact it was, you were being treated exactly the same way I was being treated, so that there was no individualized service being provided, that was a security. If that was the prevailing rule, if that really was going to be the law, then it meant that a lot of things that very blue chip investment advisors were doing in separate accounts were at least subject to the argument that they were an illegally unregistered investment company. And it seemed wrong to have that be the conclusion. So there was a mini account project that I worked on along with others. And that was probably the principal thing that we did on the Advisors Act from 72 to 75.
They ultimately come up with an Office of Investment Advisor regulation in 1978. What was that?
It was administratively, it was in the same group that Sid Mendelson headed that had exemptive applications. So it was, from my personal geographic perspective, it was on the other side of the division. I didn't have anything to do with it.
Okay.
Sid also had responsibilities for inspections and examinations. So for him, it was another way of, since he had examination responsibility for advisors, it was a way for him to also affect the law.
Maybe we could talk generally about the exemptive authority and the role that it played in the division's activities. It's a broad question, I know.
No, but it's by far the most interesting thing about the division, and it's very misunderstood, but not in a bad way. So if you worked in CorpFin or you worked in Market Reg, and somebody asked you a question like, let's just make it a silly question, like, what's a security? The only way you could respond was with a no action letter, and then you had to interpret the statute. By contrast, because Section 6C exists and 17B and the other sections that allow the SEC to grant exemptive relief, and the exemptive relief allows you to take into account, you can ask the person to agree to prophylactic conditions or you can impose restrictions, but you can exempt them from a restriction in the statute that's harsh or doesn't make any sense in his context and sort of, I don't want to say make up, but provide a different prophylactic investor protection structure, it made the way all the divisions did their work very different. So in chief counsel, we never worried that if you said no to someone, that yes, we're not going to interpret the word that way, that the life came to an end, that something awful was going to happen. Whereas that's CorpFin and Market Reg had that problem all the time. Instead, we could say that's a terrible question for a no action letter. Why don't you file an exemptive application? If you're willing to do this and this and this, we'll say yes. And it was better than a no action letter because if you got an order, it was basically the good housekeeping seal of approval from the SEC, and it was valid as against any third party. So unless the SEC process was bad, that is, it was for sort of 14th Amendment procedurally defective, it was a much better way of handling questions and the ability from the division standpoint, you could experiment. So let's say we're going ahead in time a little bit, but let's say in the mid-80s, first Vanguard and then T. Rowe Price both filed applications with the SEC asking for relief from the funds of funds provisions. So they negotiated a lot and they came up with different ways of addressing the problems that had caused the prohibition on fund of funds. It didn't mean the prohibition was wrong, but it meant that if you did other things, it was possible from an investor protection standpoint to say yes. And those two firms got orders. It was controversial. The vote was 3-2. But they went forward, and the SEC could observe it. In the real life, they could go inspect them, do whatever they wanted. And 4 or 5 years later, they came back and amended the orders, and the whole concept of fund-to-fund sort of got to blossom because you didn't have to say, no, the statute says you can't do that. Go away forever. It just meant that divisions always had, this is sort of on the one hand, anybody with a forever stamp can file an application and make your life miserable by asking you to address something that you have no interest in addressing. On the other hand, with that same forever stamp, somebody can file an exemptive application for something that would be illegal if you had to apply Section 17 literally. But with some modifications, you can make it work and they can accomplish what they want. And you've done nothing to damage investor protection. No other division's ever had that capacity. So when I gave you this long list of things that have happened over the course of the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, and 2000s, almost every single one of those is a use, I would say, an imaginative, creative, and thoughtful use of exemptive authority to let people do something that would otherwise be illegal. We're, again, jumping ahead in time, the idea that you wouldn't mark to market is sort of like the end of the earth. There's no regulator anywhere, bank regulator, insurance regulator, or securities regulator, who doesn't want people to mark to market of all the things you do. Because every morning, if you've marked to market when you went to, before you went to bed tonight, in the morning, you know how much cash you have and you know how much capital you have. Why would you ever want to give that up? So, of course, the 40 Act makes every mutual fund mark to market every single day. So the idea of a money market fund that doesn't mark to market is sort of perverse in that that's the apotheosis of what the statute tells you to do. And it took a couple of years of an administrative hearing and ultimately Rule 207. But it was the idea of saying that a product that has a stable net asset value per share is a product that would be helpful to consumers, would be helpful to trust departments and institutional investors. And because it's a product that probably ought to exist, we shouldn't just say no because the statute says you have to mark to market. And at the beginning of money market funds, that's what people were doing. They were marking to market, but within a very narrow range so that the NAV didn't fluctuate over under a dollar. In the case of institutions like Merrill Lynch, they did what's called penny rounding, and they kept doing stock splits and stock dividends in order to make everything come back to a dollar. Mm-hmm. But that you understand what I'm saying? They were marking to market, but it was causing great dislocations mm-hmm. in order to do it. And all we had to do was say yes to the idea of mark to market. But that's also an example of a situation.
Sorry, yes to the idea of mark to market.
Having a stable net asset value per share and basically making the mutual fund industry mark to market beside the stable net asset value. So you can see if the pretend price mm-hmm. or the accounting price that we're using is varying dramatically from the day-to-day mark to market price. But that's also one of those situations where the five commissioners had very strong views about wanting to mark to market, and the SEC staff was less opposed to the idea, but were pretty much told, because you get instructions, they are your bosses, you get instructions on what to do. And when the commission set it down for a hearing, then procedurally the division was required to oppose the applications. It does mean that you get a record. Anytime you have somebody opposing someone else, you get two advocates fighting on both sides, you do get a record. But it's also a funny place to create a record because you're not doing it in front of your bosses, the commission, and you're not doing it in front of your colleagues. You're doing it in front of an administrative law judge who has no particular commitment to the industry, to the statute, to the product, to anything. He's just an independent person. And it's very hard for him to take policy considerations into account.
So when you say that the exemptive authority is misunderstood, but not in a bad way, what exactly do you mean by that?
I think most people, who are either 33 Act junkies or 34 Act junkies, that's where their home is and they love those statutes and they spend a lot of time engaging with them, always find the 40 Act mysterious because a lot of the jurisprudence is sort of subterranean. It's not in a rule and it may not be in a no action letter, but it may well be in an exemptive order. And if you're trying to practice law from Spokane, Washington, and that you don't know that, then all of a sudden you can't do what the person in New York can do. And it's not because he's any smarter. He just actually gets the game that a lot of the yes answers aren't in rules. They're in exemptive applications. Now, one of the things we tried to do when I went back in 1978 was codify a bunch of that stuff so it would disappear out of the sort of subterranean jurisprudence and become a rule, and that also would mean that then we could get the lawyers involved and the accountants involved as sort of part of our compliance team to go make sure that if we passed a rule saying you could do cross transactions between two affiliated accounts under Rule 17A7, then both the lawyers and the accountants would pay attention to that, and we could make the board of directors pay attention to it, and then we didn't have to do it anymore.
That's my understanding. I was speaking to Joel Goldberg a couple
yes.
weeks ago.
Yes.
That if you're an investment company, generally it's preferable to try and get a no action letter rather than to go for an exemption because of the just on a procedural level. Is that your perception?
It all depends at the point in time. If the person you're dealing with is flexible and comfortable and in his own human skin a risk taker, then there's less process around a no action letter and it can be easier to get it done. And you can negotiate sort of directly over the phone. It has always been true that the people processing exemptive applications are very much trapped by precedent to the point where if you try and change what the last person did. So the joke has always been that if the last person was a red-headed, left-handed stepchild, then the next person better be a left-handed, red-headed stepchild or he won't get the same relief. And it may turn out that being left-handed, red-headed, and a stepchild weren't critical to getting the relief. It's just what that person was. But it's hard. But then you've got to persuade the JS-11 or JS-12 lawyer that those really weren't critical, that it's these other things that were the important investor protections. It's the exemption staff has traditionally just been more rigid in the way that they apply things. Hmm.
Just a kind of an order of magnitude level, what would the volume of exemption applications be at the SEC during the 70s?
During the 70s? I would have said we probably had 200, 250 a year.
Yeah.
And the no action letters would have been less than 100.
Okay. That's good. That helps put things in perspective. So there had been the 1970 amendments to the 40 Act a little bit before you arrived, and I know that there were still activities related to that in that early to mid-70s time frame. Could you talk about some of the things that you had been dealing with respect to that?
There were still things left over. Some of the Alan Rosenblatt was very involved in the negotiations in 69 and 70, as had Alan Mostoff and Lou Mendelson, and so they had sort of a list of things that they wanted to clean up. Some of the things were harder to do, and some of the things that were added in 1970 sort of lost some of their purpose. So the classic one was Section 17J. At the time, in 1969, there was no cause of action. It wasn't clear that there would be a cause of action for a mutual fund to sue someone who was an employee who had purchased and sold a security because the mutual fund wasn't on the other side of the buy and sell. They just happened to hold something that the human being traded. Mm-hmm. It wasn't clear that there was standing to get anywhere under Rule 10b-5. So the solution was to add an anti-fraud provision to Section 17J1 or 17J. And so the rule languished because the industry wasn't thrilled about codes of ethics, and they certainly weren't thrilled about having personal securities transactions regulated by a rule. But it lasted a long time, and when I got there, Chairman Williams said it had been there long enough. So one summer for 2 months, it was my job to collect up everything, repropose it, get it published, get it adopted, and get it done.
Okay. And so I know that there were a few other things. I apologize because of having talked to
Joel
a couple weeks ago, so everything is kind of reflected through, you know, the things that he said. But
He had the other side. At the time, he had the other side of the division. So either his group was working on it or my group was working on it. I'm not surprised.
So there will be things that you probably wouldn't have as much insight on that he would, and vice versa.
Right.
So one thing that he mentioned is that by the time that he had arrived, contractual plans had been pretty much destroyed by the amendments, that they were already on their way out, and that was hastened.
He would have been conscious of that because his group would have been processing their registration statements. Since the 40 Act was amended in 70, there wasn't anything for the exemption people to do. So we were, I don't want to say blissfully ignorant, but it wasn't something that had to pass our desks daily. I can see on the list, he also was the one who was responsible for reproposing Rule 22D1. Mm-hmm. My group wouldn't have had anything to do with sales loads. None of us had anything to do really with excessive fees. We were all very conscious of the Rosenfeld case, and then later the litigation that's popped up in 1980 and 1982 on money market funds. But other than watching it, there really wasn't much of anything for us to do.
Mm-hmm. So were there other things that were going on? I know there are very broad changes in the mutual fund industry at this time, and maybe we should discuss those. in terms of how they would have impacted what was going on in the division, your part of the division?
78 to 81. That's the time frame you want to talk about?
No, the earlier time that you were there.
Oh,
Maybe those hadn't quite worked their way through yet.
The biggest thing from our perspective was the 75 amendments.
Mm-hmm.
So we were responsible for Section 13F. I was the one whose pen had to write that. And I helped with the Division of Market Regulation draft Section 28E. But there wasn't much. It was mostly reform to the 34 Act, mm-hmm. and what was being called the Big Bang, because they were going to deregulate fixed minimum commissions on the New York Stock Exchange. There wasn't much of that had any effect on us. When it finally happened, I think we proposed and passed Rule 17E1 in the 78-79 era, but that all that did was make it permissible for mutual funds to pay something other than a fixed minimum commission, as mm-hmm. long as they kept records about it.
What was the situation with respect to the relationship between mutual funds and banks and insurance companies at that particular time, just to give us situate us there historically?
When the comptroller in 1961 decided that it was lawful, notwithstanding the Glass-Steagall Act, for banks to be involved in commingled managing agency accounts, the then SEC chairman, a former Columbia law professor, told him that from one government agency speaking to another, he could say whatever he wanted about the banking laws, but it didn't make any difference on whether or not it was a security. So when you go look at the history of it, for 3 or 4 years, there were hearings on whether commingled managing agency accounts were a security, whether they weren't, whether they had to register as an investment company. And it's sort of interesting. Citibank throughout the 70s and 80s and 90s was always very aggressive about basically not fighting with the SEC and doing whatever it took to actually get in the business, whereas others always wanted to make the moral point and win or lose on that. So they actually registered an investment company. It required some exemptive relief. The SEC got it, gave it to them. And
is it Citibank?
Yes.
Yeah.
The Citibank Fund.
Okay.
Right. And at the same time, the comptroller had to give them exemptive relief from Reg 9, the regulation 12 CFR 0.9 that regulates bank fiduciary activity, so that they could have independent directors. The NASD then sued the SEC over the exemptive relief, and the ICI sued the Comptroller of the Currency over the Glass-Steagall relief. All of this got mixed into the 1970 amendments because the Congress wanted to not be in the middle of that fight. They didn't want to sort out whether the securities industry sort of had a monopoly on mutual funds or whether the banking industry could join. So it got the 40 Act had put in it a number of provisions that would have permitted banks to offer mutual funds, and the same parallel provisions in the Bank Holding Company Act. The Bank Holding Company Act amendments of 1970 were going through Congress at exactly the same time. So you've got these three tracks: ICI versus Camp in the courts, mutual fund reform going through the Senate Banking Committee, and banking reform going through the Banking Committee. So it was both of them in the Banking Committee at the same time. So they had the classic smoke-filled room, literally, and when the votes happened, the Senate decided that they would strip out of the Investment Company Act all the permissive stuff that would have allowed banks to be in the mutual fund business and let whatever the Supreme Court decided in ICI versus Camp be the law. So when ICI versus Camp was decided in spring of 71, And what the Supreme Court decided was it was illegal for a bank to be the investment to underwrite shares of a commingled managing agency account. They were interpreting the Glass-Steagall Act, and so it basically stopped those kinds of banking activities literally for 15 years. On the other hand, the Federal Reserve had the authority under Regulation Y after it was amended in the Bank Holding Company Amendment to let banks do anything that was closely related to banking. So they proposed to allow a bank holding company or a bank affiliate give investment advice to a closed-end fund. And that litigation was decided in 1981. But in the meantime, there was stuff going back and forth between the banks and the SEC on whether things were legal. At the same time, the case is called Bloom in 1976, New York Stock Exchange versus Bloom, the banking commissioner, the Comptroller of the Currency, decided it would be okay for a bank to accept orders from its accounts and place them with a real broker-dealer on a prescribed basis. So in your personal checking account, they would take money out let's say, $25 every month on sort of kind of like a payroll deduction plan. Mm-hmm. And they would buy securities with it, and the securities would be held at Merrill Lynch. And not surprisingly, the mutual fund industry wasn't very happy about that either, nor was the brokerage industry. So if you think of the Glass-Steagall Act as prohibiting a bank from being an underwriter from being a deposit taker, the early fights in the 70s and early 80s were all about what the securities laws and banking laws meant when they were all passed in the 1930s by exactly the same committee in exactly the same period of time using exactly more or less the same words. So not surprisingly, when the Supreme Court litigated decisions, decided all this in the 1980s, they pretty uniformly took the view that if the word security meant, if commercial paper was a security for purposes of the securities laws, it sure as hell had to be a security for purposes of the banking laws, because they were decided at the same time, and therefore underwriting commercial paper was illegal. That was the Bankers Trust case. The SEC was involved in all of that stuff in the 70s and 80s because the banking industry was trying to interpret what we kept thinking of as our words in ways that would be permissive mm-hmm. from an activity standpoint by, I don't want to say distorting the words because that's not fair, but by interpreting the words in a way that would allow it, the activity to be permissive even though it had implications for us. So we were actively involved in 78 to 381, actively involved in talking to the Federal Reserve and the Comptroller about securities activities, and we didn't participate in any of the cases, but we participated informally in conversations with the Federal Reserve Board and the Comptroller of Currency on all the banking cases.
Is that something that you got involved with personally
in
78, or was it before that?
It was before that. From 72 to 75, it was me mm-hmm. because of the time that I had spent at Penn thinking about the banking laws, and it was me again after 1978. From 75 to 77, it was Jack Murphy, who was then working for Harvey Pitt.
Okay, terrific. Should we go into how you got and came back to the SEC in 78, or is there something that we should deal with before then?
I wasn't really expecting to come back, and I was surprised. Ralph Ferrara called. I was teaching at Duke, and as it turned out, Alan Mostoff had left the SEC, and Jones had left the SEC, and Sid Mendelson was an associate director, and they were trying to decide what to do. And basically, the senior management had, for their own personal reasons, had moved on. And Harold felt that he didn't understand enough about the division, and he wanted to talk to somebody. So Ralph arranged for me to fly from Duke to the SEC, then still at 500 North Capitol. My memory is I did it three or four times. Maybe I did it more, maybe I did it less.
What was Ralph Ferrara's position?
He was executive assistant to the chairman.
Okay.
So I basically sat in Harold Williams' office for 2 hours or 3 hours of an evening several times over the course of maybe a month, and gave him ideas on what I would do if I were him to make the investment management division work better, to stop criticism from the industry that we were stifling innovation and killing them with disclosure that wasn't fair. I mean, you can probably imagine the normal complaints. And then sort of put it out of my mind. And out of the blue, it must have been April, maybe it was early May, because I was already planning for the next semester. As you know, in academia, you're always planning at least a half a semester ahead, if not more. Mm-hmm. And he called and said, Harold wants to appoint you to a position. And I was stunned because I did not realize I'd ever filed a job application, nor did I think that one was available. So I left the SEC in 1975 as a GS-13 Step 2 and came back in 1978 as an SES-1, which is basically a GS-16 mm-hmm. in the old language. So I hop-skipped over a number of people who had been my supervisors and ended up being their supervisor. And I think at the time I was the youngest person to ever be appointed an associate director, and I don't think anybody else younger has ever been given that job.
How old were you at the time?
32.
32, all right.
Seven years out of law school.
Terrific. So tell me then, what was your focus then? Joel was saying that he had a series of responsibilities and that you then were the other associate director.
Right, correct.
And you had the other set of responsibilities.
So I had the Investment Company Act study.
Mm-hmm.
I had exemptive applications. I had insurance products, and I had the inspection program.
Okay.
And so what we were trying to do, the Investment Company Act study, we made up out of thin air. We just decided, and the purpose of it was to go do what others did, you can see from the red book on my bookshelf, did in 1992, which was to go sort of comprehensively look at everything and see what could be changed or improved or abandoned, whatever the right answer was. And among other things, one of our goals was to go take a hard look at every single type of Investment Company Act application that was done repeatedly. So that we, and the goal was to adopt a rule that would basically supplant the need for people to have to apply and us to do one-on-one counseling with individual applicants. And I think over a period of about 2.5 years, I once knew this by heart, but I think we adopted more than 25 rules. It meant that we were viewing it sort of administratively. We were at the commission table almost once every 2 or 3 weeks with either a proposed rule or a rule to be adopted. So we really, really tried. I wouldn't want to say jam things through, but we had momentum and we wanted to use it. Mm-hmm. The theme was to try and get rid of as many applications as we could in the conflict of interest area in Section 17. The theme was to try and find a way to make the rule dependent upon review by the independent directors, so that we could basically make the directors, the accountants, and the lawyers do our work for us, but be the first point of contact instead of us.
Mm-hmm.
When you have that much of the game, or have that much of control of the agenda, it also means that you can cause things to be handled one way versus another. So a lot of it was figuring out what to do with people. If you're trying to find a way to make their jobs interesting, then one of the things to do was to have people who had been involved in exemptive applications go on field trips, join the inspection people, go to Indianapolis and go visit a very large investment advisor, which would give them a very real-world experience, have them come back and have to write up the exam report, and then if there was something that was wrong, they got to follow up on the enforcement case. So it made being involved much more real than just getting a piece of paper from Sullivan and Cromwell and having Sullivan and Cromwell tell you what the real world looked like. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying they would tell you something was false. I'm just saying there was no independent way to have, for somebody who was 2 or 3 years out of law school, to have any more personal knowledge. It was also, in addition to money market funds, which basically from that perspective was an exemptive application, we also had, and we were sort of deeply involved, and I wouldn't want to say fighting with the bank people, but there was constant jockeying about where banks would be allowed to fit into the securities laws. But the same thing was going on with insurance products. So in one way, I've always thought of that period from 78 to 81 as being just an incredibly remarkable time, because the insurance people had to come and explain what their products were to you. The single premium deferred annuities was the product of the time, and we were worried that it was a security, and ended up writing a release 6051, that was basically the law for another 10 or 15 years. Another release that people still talk about today, for better or for worse, is...
What did the release state?
It restated the principles upon which an insurance policy would be deemed to be a security. And you'll see one theme here is that I didn't try and answer questions. I tried to have the SEC state policy upon which the questions would be evaluated, so that we could again make the private sector do as much of the decision making as they could. So whether a separate account is a security question, we turned it to the opposite. We published a release that became proposed rule 3A4 that takes the position that if the level of individualization is sufficient, that if I really am giving you personalized service, then it's not the same as I'm giving the other person, even if we end up owning the same kinds of securities, because I've looked at your financial circumstances, I've thought a lot about you, I've tried to figure out what kind of taxes you paid, how many children you have, what your investment goals are, and I may have decided on these securities, and I may decide on similar securities for him, but it's based on the same evaluation. I didn't think we could ever say what a security was. It would be too hard for CorpFin to ever come to grips with that, and enforcement either, because it would be too many situations where they'd want to say it was something else. But we could always say what it wasn't, and an individualized service was what it wasn't. So part of the goal was just to bring as much certainty to the area as we could. For lawyers, uncertainty is it's work, because it means you have to think about things, but it also means that you may or may not be taking risks that you fully understood.
Mm-hmm. So in light of that goal, did the industry view that as a successful set of
rules? Some yes and some no. The releases that came out then were long, they were academic, they were footnoted, and they were thorough. And that did get comments from the industry about a long, careful footnoted releases. But and we put stuff in footnotes that we that were division positions that might not have ever otherwise seen the light of day, which was, I thought, a healthy thing, because then everybody would know about it. That guy in Spokane who wasn't reading all the releases or reading the new action letters or whatever could read a release and find it out for himself. Some of the rule proposals, like Rule 3A4, weren't popular because the ICI was concerned that anybody with a computer who was smart enough could provide something that would look like individualized service, but in fact it would just be an illegally unregistered investment company. So it sort of all depends. I think people were generally very happy with the array of conflicts rules that we adopted, all of which are still in the books and many of which have never been changed.
So we were talking about money market funds earlier within the context of the exemptive authority. But is there more that we want to say about this? I know that this has been a particular specialty of yours. So I don't know. We talked about the different kinds of pricing of the fund, the NAV.
It was a good experience and a bad experience. And I think we, as a group, learned from it. At the same time we were doing that, we were processing the Vanguard exemptive application. Mm-hmm. And the Vanguard plaintiff asked for the hearing to be in Philadelphia. And we ended up having to have Arthur Brown go live in Philadelphia, I think for like 3 or 4 months, in order to prosecute it. And so we realized we had a flaw in the procedural rules that allowed the applicant, the protestant, to decide where the hearing was going to be. In the case of money market funds, from 75 to 76, the commission had been very, at best, lukewarm about money market funds. I mean, perhaps more fairly, they were opposed. They simply didn't want to let anybody not mark to market. Mm-hmm. So Federated filed, asked for a hearing, got an appearance before the commission, and then procedurally, under the rules, the only thing you can do is if Federated proceeds, was either to sue them or to make them file an exemptive application. They filed the application, and then procedurally, your only choices are to either comment on it or set it down for a hearing. So the commission set it down for a hearing, and that, of course, caused the industry, essentially, to everybody to want to mimic Federated. If Federated was going to get an order that would allow them to do it, everybody else wanted one too. So all of a sudden, we had a sort of this open-end hearing where everybody and his brother could join. And under the commission's rules, everybody and his brother got procedural rights. So every time somebody new would join, it was as if we had to go start the whole thing all over again. So we had to find some way to sort of bring the hearing to a stop and deal with it substantively with whoever was standing in front of us, and no more. And then also figure out a way to handle a hearing in front of an administrative law judge. And I still believe it's very hard to do policy in front of an administrative law judge. You can certainly do facts and credibility and witnesses, but policy is hard. And it's not that they're stupid, it's just unfair because it's not part of the normal job description for them. So ultimately, where we got was a settlement in the middle of the hearing. It was agreed that the applicants and the division would agree about a set of conditions, which are basically the core of Rule 2A7. And then because there was a hearing, I had to ask all the applicants to give me the authority to appear before the commission without them present, which is also considered naughty because I was a party to the hearing, but I was going to go talk to the ultimate judges in the appellate court, if you will, without anybody else being present. But it was also agreed that I was the only one who was going to be able to persuade the commission to say yes based on the compromise we'd come up with. So we did, and the commission did approve it, and we issued exemptive orders to, I think, the 22 applicants that were in the hearing. And then I think it's like 82 or 83 when Rule 2A7 finally gets proposed mm-hmm. and adopted.
What was the source of the commission's discomfort in this situation?
They were just afraid that no one should be exempt from marking to market, mm-hmm. and that there would if the if you this is never going to show up in the transcript, so I'm going to use my hands like you would in a classroom.
Okay.
But if you leave the net asset value stable, but in the real world, the actual value of the portfolio is going up and down. Mm-hmm. What we agreed is that the prophylactic condition would be that that range had to be monitored. And if something happened, the NAV went too high, the actual mark-to-market NAV went too high, it went too low, things had to happen. And that the board had to do things, or at least had to think about things. They were just afraid that people, the sponsors, would abandon the mark-to-market, would abandon the NAV, undo the mark-to-market, and leave the investors basically having lost a penny of principal. So let's not think of a human being for a second, but think of a trust account. Mm-hmm. So we've set up a trust account for your children, and some of your children are the income beneficiaries, but you still have the hopes of having more children, so they would be the remainderman. If you lose a penny of principal in order to get another dollar of income for the income beneficiaries, you've hurt the remainderman to the benefit of the income beneficiaries. And it was hard to see why that would ever be good investor protection. As it's turned out, as you know, the sponsors have done exactly the opposite. Every single time they have a security that gets in trouble or distressed in whatever way, it has to be written down. It's either got a credit quality problem or a credit quality timing problem. Almost always the sponsors have stood up. The number of exceptions are, you can count them literally on one hand. And the most obvious one was right there in September of 2008. Or the reserve fund.
So that was one aspect of kind of the aftermath of 2A7 that I wanted to ask about. Now, it's also a fairly complicated rule, too, in terms of the prescriptions involved for the requirements on money market funds, too, in terms of what they can and cannot invest in and so forth.
It's highly prescriptive.
Yes.
And the original version had restrictions, but it was more principles oriented. And it's got one of the things with rules that are highly prescriptive is that it sort of encourages people to cheat right up to the edge of the rule, mm-hmm. rather than say, I know that's wrong and I shouldn't do it. And so once you start down a prescriptive road, you just have to keep prescribing until you've prescribed every ounce of risk out of it. The other thing about money market funds is that originally it was understood that if a money market fund broke a dollar, that's just what happened, mm-hmm. and everybody would have to live with it. So you're a historian. If you were an economist, then I would say to you, if you own shares of a money market fund, what you actually own is an equity security in a corporation or a trust, and it owns short-term debt. That's what a money market fund is. That's what a securities lawyer would say. A banking lawyer would say a money market fund is an unlicensed lender with a lousy appetite for risk. And they'd be describing exactly the same thing. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that we always thought about, that the SEC's always focused about, not surprisingly, is the investor protection angle of it. And they've never wanted anybody to lose any money, which makes you be highly restrictive. Mm-hmm. Whereas from a banking perspective, money market funds have supported upwards of 50% of all the short-term financing in the United States, which is stunning. But that's the focus on what they buy as distinct from what they sell. And, of course, the point of sale is where the SEC is always intensely focused.
I know there was some concern as time went on that as in these instances where money market funds get bailed out, that would also tend to push them towards being a bit more risky as well. Is that so?
It has the funny effect in a board meeting. You could hear somebody from the advisor say, okay, I've now bailed out this money market fund four times. Mm-hmm. Next time my investment advisory fee comes around for review, I don't expect to get a hard time. Mm-hmm. Because there's only so many times you can bail out principal. Sometimes it doesn't hurt very much. If it's not a credit problem, let's say it's an interest rate readjustment problem, so that there's no question that it's going to get paid. It could be a Fannie Mae bond or a Ginnie Mae bond, but it has an interest rate reset that makes it out of the market. Ultimately, it will get paid. So the only difference between its mark-to-market value now and its maturity value is the time value of money with the interest rate reset. So there's no principal risk. That's very different from something that gets downgraded from A1, P1 to A2, P2 to A3, P3. It is true that at the earliest days of money market funds, people who needed very high 12b1 fees in order to sell and carry the money market fund tended to buy A2 and P2 and A3 P3 paper in order to goose the yield, in order to create the income from which the 12b1 fee would be paid. That is true.
So did you have anything to do then with the study on disclosure?
Not me. That was Joel.
That was Joel? Okay. And, of course, Joel told me quite a bit about the background to 12b1 and the rationale underlying it. So did you have anything to do with that either?
Well, it was actually money market funds that were the problem because they couldn't – they were – if it was Merrill Lynch, they could basically – they could sell your IBM shares and you could be – and it would take 2 or 3 days for the money to clear. And with the proceeds, Merrill Lynch would keep the float. And they could use the float to pay their broker-dealers to basically continue to talk to you about your money market fund shares, even though they weren't getting a commission or a sales load. With other places, one of the things that that we kept hearing in the industry that people were doing was making payments to people for distribution that clearly had to have come out of the advisory fee, but equally clearly weren't being paid by the advisor. Often it was a parent or an affiliate. And we kept trying to track down where that money was going to come from, because the theology about Rule 12b1 is you shouldn't be paying for distribution out of the advisory fee. Mm-hmm. And the facts were pretty clear, that's exactly what was happening. Joel probably said the same thing, but we had a commission who wasn't real eager to adopt Rule 12b1. And the argument we made, Joel, Sid, and I, was that it would be better to have a Rule 12b1 that put all the facts on the table and got all the payments where people could see them and have the directors surveil them than it was to have payments where we couldn't see them, we couldn't surveil them, and it was affecting distribution. And the only part of Rule 12b1 that I can lay personal claim to, Joel and Dick Grant did most of the work, was to figure out the tautology, which is that if what you're being paid is legitimate profit within the meaning of 36B, then whatever you pay for distribution is okay, because you could have paid for a national park, you could have paid higher salaries, you could have bought a bigger building, you could have done all sorts of things. And it's your choice rather than keep the money that you plow it back into the business by paying 12b1 fees. But because the problem we had, of course, is that the people who had the money market funds that had small loads were being handled very differently than, say, a T. Rowe Price or a Dreyfus that had no load. They had no way of paying people to continue to give investment advice. And we had the intellectual problem explaining why they could pay for distribution, but it would be illegal for somebody without a 12b1 plan to pay for distribution. So I'm the creator of that long paragraph that explains the tautology.
Okay. So another thing that I understand you're involved with was the business development companies, the provisions for them, and the Small Business Securities Act amendments of 1980, if I have that right.
There was the senior senator from Texas. We had a number of venture capital people and some specific SBICs who were unhappy with the way they were being treated in the 40 Act, and they did not think they would be treated fairly in attempting to get exemptive relief. So they captured the attention of the senior senator from Texas, and he put a hold on the SEC's appropriation. And if I remember correctly, it would have been the first time ever that we would have had an appropriation for more than 1 year. It was going to be a 2-year appropriation. And, of course, anytime anybody puts a hold on your appropriation, the whole agency is looking right at you. Mm-hmm. And so I got instructions from Harold Williams and Steve Friedman was appointed to be my mentor. And the two of us went over, Steve and I went over the hill to the Senate and started negotiating with the NASBIC people, the National Association of SBICs, and a lawyer representing the NVCA, the National Venture Capital Association. That lasted from April through September. And during that 6 months, my job was to do my regular job half of every day. And half of every day was to work on legislation that would be acceptable to that group of people, because until we got something that was acceptable to everybody, mm-hmm. the senator from Texas was prepared not to remove the hold on our appropriation. So it meant in a very hot summer, walking from 500 North Capitol all the way over the house and back. It also meant getting home at 8 or 9 o'clock every night, which wasn't much fun. I had a new baby. But mostly what we figured out was that at the end of the day, what we came up with, the so-called BDC rules, are a package of provisions that, leaving aside the fact that they're attached to the Investment Company Act, would have been the rules that we would have created had someone been willing to file an exemptive application and had we had to give them an order. That was the metric I used to try and figure out whether things that they wanted were fair or whether they were unusual. The reason they have a different scheme is because it was argued to us that they have a different business. Whether it's Fidelity or Dreyfus or Vanguard, they rarely have anything to do with management. Whereas with a venture capital fund, one of the things they do is help some guy who's created the new drug to cure cancer, wears a white coat, kills mice, you know, does experiments, but has no idea about marketing or finance. If they are the seed capital for his adventure, then he needs help to get from that thing that he's doing with the white coat to somewhere where he's actually a company. And they swore up and down that's what they did. Mm-hmm. So we exempted them. Among the things that they were exempted from were all the concentration and diversification requirements in the 40 Act, rather as distinct from the Internal Revenue Code, so that they could basically concentrate in just a venture capital type investments. But the price was that if the goal here was sort of in the same way that we heard to one presidential campaign ago, it was all about, you know, who creates jobs. Well, this has to be about who puts money in America. So what the thing that made it work politically was that they had to buy stock in a venture capital company. They couldn't buy stock in a secondary market. They couldn't buy stock in a public company. So they could buy stock or debt. We didn't care how they financed them. But the idea was that the venture capital company was technically or practically incapable of financing itself through the normal markets or the normal credit sources, and VCs were going to be the alternative.
Is this something that had at all been on the SEC's radar prior to this situation?
From the standpoint of being barked at that we weren't being helpful to them, yes, because they hadn't presented a story that could be heard that was different from the story that mutual funds were telling. It was hard to see why they needed exemptive relief that was any different, because the investor protection concerns were the same. So in order to give them some help on the conflicts of interest, we let the board deal with conflicts of interest where the conflict was remote, where the conflict is direct. They still have to come to the SEC the same way any mutual fund would have to. But we gave, they have to, and for the first time, Rule 12b1 was the first time a rule required that someone have at least 50% independent directors. BDCs by law in the 40 Act must have at least 50% independent directors.
So, unless there are particular legal issues that you think that we should talk about from this period, I was wondering if I could ask some just general questions about the people around you, Sid Mendelson in particular. If we should stay on kind of the legal side of things.
I was looking at what was left. No, that's fine.
Okay.
Yeah, that's fine.
All right, so... Yes, I understand that Mendelson had been there for quite a long time, and that...
Did Joel tell you that he started out in the mailroom as a messenger?
No, I don't think he did. Maybe he did. I'd have to check the transcript.
They were good personal friends, but that's where he started out. So mm-hmm. We're talking about a guy who went to law school at night, and I can't remember whether he went to GW or Georgetown, but and he was at the SEC during World War II, so part of the time was in Philadelphia. And he was at the SEC before it was at 500 North Capitol Street. So he'd been there literally forever. He commuted from Silver Spring with three other people who were very much like him, from the old school. And, of course, Sid, because of the way he grew up, Sid had very, very good judgment about what was right and wrong and the arguments that you could accept and arguments you couldn't accept from the industry. And he'd done enforcement cases with Dave Butowski and that crowd, and had been involved in the cases against Roy Cohn and Fifth Avenue Coachline. So he had a sort of enforcement mentality. But I think anybody who knows him knows that he's a completely lovable person, but in terms of social graces or ability to write or ability to communicate, like using President Obama as the mm-hmm. as the metric, which is very unfair. That wasn't him. Mm-hmm. So we we all enjoyed sort of treating him as Uncle Sid. I mean, I don't think anybody ever called him that, but he got more than his fair share of practical jokes played on him because he was the perfect foil. My personal favorite was we would go from, every now and then we'd all go over to the Hyatt that's right across the street by Georgetown Law School. And Sid was always a very modest buyer of things at lunch, and the Hyatt was a little above his what he figured was an appropriate expense for lunch. So we'd always try and get his wallet out on the table so we could make change, because it was only fair to pay the waitress in money, not in credit cards. So if we could do it, we'd always try and get a 20 out of his wallet and make sure that no more than 5 got back. And he never bought anything that was more than $5 or $6, so we were clearly bilking him. And if you just move the money around fast enough with everybody cooperating, we could effectively get $20 out of him for a lunch that was maybe only 5. At one point, he started bringing along Gene Golke and making him bring along his pocket calculator because he knew we were screwing him, but he couldn't quite figure out how we'd managed to do that. He was also famous for hooking up his trailer to the back of his, I can't remember what kind of car he had, but dragging it all the way from Florida for a 6-week vacation. When you're the age I was at, the idea that you would take 6 weeks off was just extraordinary. But he and Stan Judd had both worked there so long that they were entitled to 6 weeks. And in the government, it's if you go away for 6 weeks, normally nobody else does your work while you're away. It's there waiting for you when you come back. So we would always try and have a little surprise for him when he'd come back. A couple of times I pretended to be Ralph Farrar or the chairman and wrote him a memo, and then we'd leave it on his desk and then tell his secretary that she wasn't allowed to call anybody. His hands were so big it was hard for him to use the dial phones. So he would usually yell at his secretary to tell her to call somebody. So he would read, like, Coke bottle's not fair, but he had sort of thick glasses. And so you could see him read, and you could see his eyes go across the page, just like an old typewriter would have. He was reading letter for letter, word for word across. And then you could see the color come up in his face. We'd always make sure we're in the room when he was reading the false emails or the false memos so that he wouldn't actually do something. But my favorite was to, when he was away, one time I made up a pretend memo where I was pretending I was Harold Williams, and I changed the inspection program so that somebody from inspections always lived in the largest broker dealers and mutual funds, because since that's where the largest problems were, it made sense to have somebody on site. I changed the name of the division and put a semicolon in the middle of it, which gave it a silly name. Just things that no one ever would have done. They were all sort of ridiculous, but it was just sort of in the nature of April Fools, and it was always fun that way to tease him. He was an extraordinarily nice man, and he had just very, very good judgment.
Bringing up the area of inspection and enforcement, maybe you could tell me a little bit about the activities of the division in that time. I understand there wasn't a whole lot of enforcement activity, but could you just give me kind of a perspective on what it was like at that time?
So we had some 40 Act cases, but the person who's almost always, some of the 40 Act prohibits the mutual fund from doing something. Some of the 40 Act prohibits an affiliated person from doing something. So if the affiliated person has caused the mutual fund to violate something only the mutual fund can violate, you basically have to prove the case against the bad guy. And then the mutual fund's the victim, even though it's the thing that's actually, from a statutory standpoint, has done the violation. It made a lot of those cases very unattractive. If you just think of it from a headline standpoint, it was very hard to convince the enforcement people that that was where you wanted them to spend their time. When inspections were part of the division, and from a zero-based budgeting standpoint, we had to pay for the inspection people in every single regional office, we got a lot of response. So when we first were concerned about money market funds and what they were buying, Sid would insist that all the various inspection groups, New York, LA, Chicago, all of them, go look at all the people who are local in their districts, and we could get like an instant survey. It was like having boots on, literally boots on the ground. So from that standpoint, it was wonderful. twice a year, Sid sponsored a had been involved for years in doing educational programs. So part of it was outreach to the regional offices. Part of it was education in the regional offices. Part of it was also helping being an agent or an advocate for the regional office when the case would come back. And there were a number of situations when we used the inspection system to get to something that would have been very hard to persuade the commission to do on the merits if we'd just gone upstairs and said, this is the regulatory proposal. And people know this story, so it's not unfair to tell it. In the San Francisco office, they had a registrant who had basically sold a bunch of treasuries and bet on treasury futures. The treasury futures were outside his investment remit, so he was out of bounds by any standards. The way he did it, virtually all the futures went bad on the same day. So he lost, this is from memory, but he lost 40% of the NAV in his fund on one day. So it was spectacular, and it was a fraud, but it wouldn't have advanced the jurisprudential ball at all to call it a securities fraud, because he had lied, by 1980, it was perfectly clear that if you lied, that violated the securities law, so we weren't going to teach anybody anything. So what we did was slow down the enforcement case. And the problem was that he'd basically bought something that was a future without setting aside money to have to pay for it. So we used that as the basis for writing release number 10666, the derivatives release. And because it involved an enforcement case, we could have the release talk. We could talk to the commission about the release and the enforcement case at the same closed meeting. And we could show them a real-life situation where somebody had done bad and done exactly what couldn't have happened had the release been in place, and then got their permission to publish the release. And we also thought about what we wanted the release to be. If we couldn't sue the California guy for violating a release, so what we had to do was announce principles. And then we could say, if we announced the principles, then if you were a lawyer in the industry, we would publish them, let's say, today. Then you'd read it in the paper tomorrow and you'd say, oh, well, the SEC is very concerned about mutual funds and derivatives, and we have to have these set-aside accounts, we have to mark to market, we have to do this, we have to do that. And I could get affirmative behavior on your part, and I haven't adopted a rule that makes you do anything. Then 2 months later, when we've settled up with the California fund, we announced the enforcement case, and now you call your clients and say, remember when I told you 2 months ago they're really concerned about derivatives? Well, look what they did to this guy. So we had a very favorable effect on something that we would have had a hard time arguing about, just a Section 18 question all on its own, but when you matched it up with something bad that happened. So I always thought it was really helpful from a number of perspectives to have the regulatory people hand in glove with the inspection people, because then you could use them like your foot soldiers, but you could also use the cases that they would find, the stuff that was really wrong, to make larger principles and teach the commission that the larger principle needed to be dealt with too. The last bullet you've got here is that the Carter years were a deregulatory time, and that's true. And so if you marched upstairs and said, I want to make this a harsher environment, it was a hard world in which to make that happen. But with Harold Williams in particular, if you told him what the problem was and you gave him a way to think about it, a year in advance, 6 months in advance, but you basically gave him expectations and gave him a script so that he knew why you were saying what you were saying, what you wanted the commission to do, then by and large, we won at the commission table. And that, to me, that's just, you know, the best way government works. You found a problem, you figured out a way to package it so that you can get a yes, and then you send the package gets published and people in the real world do what you want.
Did the resources that you have for inspection have anything to do with the work you were doing with the study in 78, and the desire to put more on the lawyers and the accountants?
Yes.
Yeah?
Yes. They were tied. We had some of the people in the study do inspections. We had, I've forgotten which office it was, I think it was Chicago, we had somebody from one of the regional offices be involved in one of the study projects. I'm misremembering, I just can't remember which person, what project, but we deliberately tried to spread the wealth around so that everybody could have a different kind of intellectual mix mm-hmm. of things they were doing. And at the semi-annual meetings we had with the inspection people, usually one or another, the regional offices would be the host. So if it was New York, maybe we'd end up in the Adirondacks and everybody would go there. Or if it was Atlanta, we'd be somewhere in the Atlanta suburbs. But then we'd use those experiences to basically teach so that the regional offices felt like they had somebody in Washington who was helping them. They also knew exactly why we were thinking what we were doing. So in their own jobs, they could anticipate that there would be an interest that they could, everybody in the home office would be very interested in knowing if there are problems with money market funds. So if you see that, raise your hand. I thought it was, again, the best way government works, where everybody had the same mission, same goal, and were working hand in glove together.
So were they pretty hard-pressed then at that time, just in terms of the number of them versus the number of people who they had to oversee?
We had zero-based budgeting, so I'd forgotten whether the inspection cycle for investment advisors was once every 5 years or once every 8 years or once every 10 years, but it was abysmal. The inspection cycle for mutual funds was much, much better. And one of the things that we tried to do was use the advisor inspection cycle to create Advisors Act enforcement cases that would be decided as Advisors Act fraud. So, and Stanley Sworkin didn't care as long as you just said the fraud words. He didn't care whether you charged 10b-5 or you charged 206, but it made a huge difference to us to be able to say that there was law that we developed under Section 206 and the fiduciary duties there that were specific to investment advisors that the inspection people could enforce. It's the same thing you've been seeing in the newspapers for the last couple of years. The same things that the inspection people have been saying about the private equity advisors is the law that we developed.
So you mentioned the kind of general deregulatory atmosphere under Carter. Now, of course, that changes under Reagan to become stronger, and he appoints John Shadd as the chairman. Did you stay for a little while when John Shadd came? I know that it was in 81, I guess, that you left.
I left in early June of 81, and I don't think he was there for more than – I don't think I overlapped with him for more than 3 or 4 months.
Okay, so you wouldn't have I mean, Joel is saying that he was interested in getting rid of the 40 Act and all of that, and so
at the philosophical level, one of the things that's very interesting is when you've kind of got a permanent staff or a permanent bureaucracy, one of the things that happens is when somebody new comes in at the top, a political appointee says, I want to do this or I want to do that, almost always it's something that the permanent staff thought about or has dealt with before, and so they can say, no, if you do that, these bad things will happen. Or we did that in 1945, and this bad thing happened. Shadd wasn't deterred by that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if you know anything about shelf registration, but the idea that you could not do the real live underwriting due diligence that everybody had done for since 1933, and in 1980, he just couldn't understand why a debt security had to go through that kind of process. So he was the one who proposed Rule 415, so-called shelf registration, where you could put in a registration statement mm-hmm. and on a moment's notice declare it effective and sell into the market that day. So it made the SEC much more responsive to the whims of the market in terms of whether that was something the market viewed favorably or unfavorably. And I've always thought that if the commission that had that question was the one that I worked for from 78 to 80, they would never have done it because mm-hmm. those were traditional securities lawyers who absolutely knew what due diligence was. They would have thought that was ridiculous. And he was just basically from a different era and a businessman. So he was trying to find a way to make things happen better, quicker, cheaper from a Wall Street industry perspective. That just made him a very different chairman.
Is there anything that you'd like to cover that we haven't discussed? Because then I think I'd like to transition into your post-SEC career.
I'd say that the 78 to 81 was an extraordinary experience because things were changing everywhere. For the first time, we had basically, in that sense, had a brand new product with money market funds. We had brand new insurance products with single premium deferred annuities. We had a brand new player in the market, meaning the banks, and we had pressure from the venture capital guys on the other end of the Investment Company Act. And I don't, there's probably somebody else who served at the SEC in some other period of time who can claim that their period was more intense, more interesting, more challenging than mine. And I know that it's sort of silly always to say that life was better way back then, mm-hmm. but, and I'm not sure life was better, but life was challenging.
Okay, so
and
then...
And of course, as you've probably figured out, every lawyer would like to be his own client, which is what you get to be when you're, when you've got the word director behind your name.
So you didn't dead leave in 81.
Yes.
Did you have any notion of staying for more than a few years, or why'd you leave?
I didn't go back with any particular time frame in mind. And I could have stayed at the... I would have been perfectly happy staying at the SEC for the rest of my life. I thought I'd achieved everything I wanted, and I wasn't sure that I would be comfortable, as comfortable with the administration that John Shadd would bring in and the people that would be on his commission as I had been with the Harold Williams Commission. In particular, Steve Friedman had been a very good friend to the division and very helpful, and it helped. Very clever, smart guy, been at the Treasury, he's very knowledgeable, a former Wall Street lawyer. I just didn't think I was going to be in quite the same group.
Mm. I probably should have asked about your experience with other commissioners as well. Is there anything more to say on that, or have we just covered it?
I think we all knew which commissioner was a Republican and which commissioner was a Democrat, mm-hmm. and we knew the story on how they got appointed, most of them, because they weren't big secrets. But I don't ever remember thinking we need to cast this project in these tones in order to capture that Republican commissioner's vote. They worked together then very collegially. If they weren't, it certainly wasn't visible to the rest of us. And even if they came, like Roberta Carmel, with a particular point of view, if you were telling her something that was essentially right and in the consumer's best interest, she would be as quick to get behind it as anybody else. I don't think I can't remember a single thing we got turned down on that we wanted that was a result of a commissioner. We did get instructions from them that were inconsistent with what the industry wanted, which meant that we found ourselves fighting for something that we didn't, as a group, necessarily believe in. But that's the boss's right. And if you think he's wrong, then you've got to go persuade him.
Okay. So then you went to private practice, I think, for the first time in your life after you left the commission.
I looked for law school jobs, and you have to sort of look a year in advance, as you know, from your own experience. So I started looking in the fall and near Christmas of 1980, going into 81, and I didn't find anything I liked. I was also, at the time, I had a brand new baby. Mm-hmm. And I kept thinking about growing up where you could throw a baseball with your kid in your own backyard. So, and we liked the house we were living in and mm-hmm. liked living here. So after sort of not liking the academic choices I had, I looked for law firms. And you're right. I started out as a partner in a Philadelphia law firm in their Washington office. And I'm probably the only person you're going to interview who was never an associate in the law firm. I started out as a partner, which is wonderful. I never had to live through what at least the associates think is agony.
Mm-hmm. So how was that transition for you? Was it a fairly simple one, moving from IM into the, I presume most of your work was in that same area, private practice?
It was representing banks, trying to get into the mutual fund business. Mm-hmm. It was representing different kinds of mutual funds. And I think you would be disappointed if when you leave the SEC, there's a group of people who are ready to hire you because it means you haven't been terribly objective and thoughtful and careful about the way you did your job when you were at the SEC. And I was always tried to be just as scrupulously fair mm-hmm. and precise as I possibly could be. And I got lucky. And in my personal practice, I've always had work come looking for me rather than having to go looking for work. So I was busy literally from day one. I showed up at work at 9 o'clock, and I got a call at 10 o'clock from Fidelity with a project. So I was busy from the beginning.
So tell me about the evolution of the of this relationship between the banking sector and the mutual fund sector moving through. Before we kind of brought the story up to that 1981 period, some of the Supreme Court cases that were decided around that time. And, of course, it continues to be, an erosion of the barrier between those areas right up until the Glass-Steagall Act, or maybe it was pretty much gone by that time. Graham-Leach-Bliley.
Right, exactly. I had it, the way life worked out for me, I represented banks in trying to help them and teach them how to be in the brokerage business and how to be in the mutual fund business. And it helped to be able to speak banking to do that, because then you could speak their own language to them and explain what they were doing in their trust department and how it matched up to what they would be doing in a mutual fund. In 1983, I think is the year, I also got asked to represent the insurance industry. So for the next 15 years, I sued either the Federal Reserve Board, the Comptroller of the Currency, or the FDIC on behalf of the insurance industry whenever they let banks do something that would let them be involved in the sale or manufacturing of insurance. And that was, it's very unusual to get to represent an entire industry on a question. And of course, what it means is that everybody in that industry is looking at every word you write, and they've all got something to say about it. So you have to be, you have to really be careful with what you're doing. And it also means that you are rolling the dice for a whole lot of people and a whole lot of lives and a whole lot of fortunes. So for the 15 years that we've represented the insurance industry, you can see that if you look over your left shoulder, you can see the feather that is what you get down a little bit lower. You can see the feather that you get when you go to the Supreme Court. And I got to be second chair in a case, what's the so-called second Valak case, was Valak versus the Comptroller of the Currency. That's huge stuff when you can actually be involved on it for an entire industry. And later I've represented the American Bankers Association. From time to time I've represented the Investment Company Institute, and I've represented other kinds of groups. And representing trade associations is a trick in itself, because you're talking about an entity that has a life, but it also has members, and the members also have interests. And the interests aren't always the same because they compete.
From a legal standpoint, what are some of the highlights of the whole history of this area? Are there particular cases that you would view as particularly significant?
Well, when you teach this, of course, it's not the way life happens. When you're living it, it's you look at things that happen in this year, and then the next year, and then the next year, and then the next year, because it's all chronology. If you can teach it, the trick is to do things by activity. So when I teach the Graham-Leach-Bliley class at Georgetown, and I used to teach it at Duke, what you would do is read the four cases that allowed banks to get into the investment advisory business. You know, that's the first class, the second for 2 hours. And the second class is read the four cases that allow banks to become broker-dealers. Mm-hmm. That's the next segment. And the last one is underwriting. And then because there's the same sequencing in insurance, it basically takes six classes, two-hour classes, so it's your half a semester, teaching how banks got involved in the mutual fund industry and how banks got involved in the insurance industry. And then you have to flip the mirror and look at the other side, because the flip side of all this that was going on at exactly the same time is if you look at this from an economic standpoint, you think, okay, banks were trying to cherry pick somebody else's industry and say, the banking business is what it is, but I would really like, let's just say, a steady stream of income. So I want to be an investment advisor, I want to be a broker-dealer, I want to be an insurance agent, because those are basically riskless in the largest sense of the word. And they are steady streams of income if you're successful in selling products. Well, if you're on the other side of the fence, you're Merrill Lynch, you look at banks, you say, what have they got that I want? And you say, wow, how do you go about getting deposits? I'd sure love to be in that business. Nobody ever wants to be in the commercial lending business, but of course the consumer lending business with 18 to 26% usury limits is also a really attractive thing. So the other side of this was a creation of non-bank banks and all the non-bank bank businesses, and the unitary savings and loan holding companies, and all the stuff where basically people tried to be something that in these days it's fashionable to call the shadow banking system. Mm-hmm. But it's basically just somebody's doing part of a function that would be part of the definition of bank if you looked in the banking statutes. And if you got the fun part was if you had to be, in order to work in this, you had to be clever in the industry that wanted to know about the other industry, mm-hmm. and you had to be clever in what they wanted to know about. So being able to be both a bank securities lawyer for banks and a bank securities lawyer for mutual funds was a great trick.
Given everything that had happened before Graham Leach Bliley, was there anything in particular that Graham Leach Bliley changed in this environment?
The principal restriction that had graded was the so-called Section 20 affiliates. Mm-hmm. They were broker-dealers that were affiliated with bank holding companies, but they limited the amount of underwriting they did so that they weren't in violation of Section 20. The limits were artificial, and not all the banks could qualify. So the very biggest of the banks, let's say the five or six biggest, could move over all their commercial, like a big part of their commercial banking business. They could move over their treasury business, and they could move over what would be called good underwriting mm-hmm. in order to engage in what was called naughty underwriting. The smaller the bank you were talking about, the less of the treasury business they had, therefore the less of the naughty underwriting they could do. So it was basically a big bank versus small bank divide without it meaning to be that way. So the big pressure was, of course, Citibank being acquiring an insurance company and wanting to be able to own the insurance company. The way they did it was to have the insurance company acquire Citibank. So the insurance company was a brand new, newly registered bank holding company. Citibank was the acquisition target. Don't tell me what the market caps were. That this is the lawyer pretend about what's going on. That meant that the insurance company only had to get permission from Connecticut for approval of its acquisition of Citibank. Citibank had to get approved by the Federal Reserve Board, and they had a brand new bank holding company sitting on the top. So the existing provisions of the Bank Holding Company Act grandfathered everything the insurance company did for 3 years and would allow it to divest the stuff slowly. That happened in 1998, so there was huge pressure to not let the 3 years run and watch the two come apart. And the Hill was pressed very hard to basically do the financial holding company provisions that allowed that transaction to exist. It was legal anyway, but it basically, grandfather's not quite right either, but it basically allowed it to exist. Then, of course, you saw a bunch of transactions right after that where Schwab bought U.S. Trust and a bunch of other things where the business proposition or the business model was always, I like what I'm doing, but I need what this other guy's doing too. But he's in a business where if I buy him, I become a bank holding company, and I don't want to be that. So the intellectual mm-hmm. part about this, is, of course, is that's exactly what Dodd-Frank does when they captured both J.P. Morgan and Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs and made them into bank holding companies and captured GE Capital and Tia Cref and some of the other, AIG and some of the other companies and called them SIFIs. It was because they basically turned them into bank holding companies.
So one of the areas that, while you were at the SEC, there was a growth in the retirement funds, IRAs
yes,
in particular,
yes.
But that becomes much greater after you leave in the 80s
yes.
and 90s and, of course,
yes.
later.
Yes.
What were some of the key issues that would have come up with that development?
During the 78 to 81 period or after that?
After that. If you have anything in particular to say about that.
We had to sort out some mm-hmm. of the, because it's just life. In 1940, when the 40 Act was adopted, there were no collective investment pension plans. Collective investment funds didn't even exist for banks until 1933, common mm-hmm. trust funds. So there was an exemption in the 40 Act for a specific plan and a trust, but not for a commingled fund. So there was a lot of carrying on in the 1960s about what ought to be the rule for pension plans. And then if you say it's okay for banks to have collective investment funds for pension plans, then you've got to say it's okay for insurance companies to do that. And so in 1970, they basically changed Section 3C11 so that it worked reasonably well, but it took clear until the 80s for the other statutes, the 34 Act or the 33 Act, to get the exemptions all paralleled up so that they all matched. I'm pretty sure it's NISMIA that conforms the 33 Act, the 34 Act, and the 40 Act so that they all have exactly the same definitions. Prior to that time, literally for 50 years, everybody had worked with inconsistent definitions, knowing full well that no one was going to do anything about it if you just did... what the Investment Company Act said. The big surprise, of course, was IRAs and then 401ks, which basically the whole theory of excluding pension plans was that the person who was in the other end of the pension plan was a corporate treasurer, right? And he was a sophisticated investor on behalf of a sophisticated company. And human beings just got income payments when they retired. They weren't involved in the money. So when Congress changed and added 401ks, and so human beings were now choosing their own pension, there wasn't the investor protection that would have been there, having the sophisticated treasurer, just didn't exist. And the 40 Act never caught up to that.
So what were the consequences of that then, as far as
a bank collective?
Well, I mean, I won't ask you to comment on the whole industry, but maybe just on the legal aspects of dealing with this area.
Well, the 1992 study spends an entire chapter trying to sort out the rationality of the different ways in which IRAs are different from 401ks, are different from guaranteed payment plans, from guaranteed defined benefit plans, from defined contribution plans. All those are perfectly, you can say all those words and they're all perfectly thoughtful, but they come out very differently depending on which one you say, what part of the law works for it. So a huge amount of the money that moved from a situation where there was a corporate treasurer responsible for it and a defined benefit being paid. So it's easiest if you just think of a Teamster. Mm-hmm. Right, I mean, he's going to get $500 a month, and that's what he's going to get, and that's just what he's been promised. And it's the institutional investor's job to make sure the money's there to pay it. It went from that to a defined contribution plan for somebody in a law firm who said, I want to put in 15% of what I make, and I'm going to invest it, and let's see how it all comes out. You know, the first guy really has a pension. Mm-hmm. Somebody like me has no pension. No one's going to give me a dollar when I retire. Whatever I've saved is all I've got. So it's my defined contribution plan that has made the difference for me, and nobody's invested the money but me. It's one of these things where the magic of people dreaming up different kinds of investment models got way ahead of the lawyers and certainly way ahead of Congress. And once any industry gets a competitive advantage, it's always been easier for the mutual fund industry to do everything. Because if it's a security, all you have to do is put more disclosure in the mutual fund prospectus. If it's a security, then it's not a banking product, and then the banks have to do something very different. Same thing with the insurance companies.
In the money market area, of course, Dodd-Frank is probably the most significant legal event in this, but I don't want to constrain your comments to that. What have been the developments there that you would like to highlight?
If this was a corporate finance class, we tried, and so you would be talking about the equation Y equals A plus BX, and X would be volatility, A would be diversification, and if you've done this right, then the graph would have a diagonal line right from the bottom axis right to the top corner, because it means what you've invested in is exactly as volatile as the market. You're not taking more risk or less risk. That models what we had in mind in 1980, and we tried to get there by making sure that money market funds could only buy A1, A2 commercial paper, and it could only own A3 if they owned it as a result of buying it before, and then there was a credit event afterwards, and that there was a judgment they should keep it. So we tried to make sure that there was no alpha risk in money market funds. The beta risk we tried to take care of by making sure that they couldn't own a security that was longer than 360 days. The average weighted portfolio maturity had to be 120 days. And as it turned out, as always will be true, the market competed against the rule and found ways to create things that would be technically in compliance with the rule but would allow people to take more risk and therefore get more yield. The other way of thinking about this is that the very first tax-exempt money market funds, people bought the last 90 days, 120 days, 5 years, or whatever, on what had been a 5 or 10 year bond. That was crazy, but they had to buy something that was that short in order to satisfy the amortized cost rules. The market reacted to that by creating demand notes that basically were a brand new thing for the marketplace solely as a result of the existence of tax-exempt money market funds. So I live in Montgomery County, Maryland, and Montgomery County Treasurer says we need 50 more buses, and we need at least 5 years to pay those off. So he floats a five-year bond at five-year interest rates. And as a taxpayer in Montgomery County, that's a general obligation bond. I have to pay it off, right? Whoever buys it gets the income. So wouldn't it be cool, and it's true, that that same guy could get a five-year bond, but if he had interest rates that reset every 30 days or every 90 days, and he had a put that allowed me to put the bond back as the buyer every 90 days if I wanted to, what he does, if you know how to draw yield curves, instead of being out here at 5 years, his yield curve is now way down here because the terms of the bond allow the market to pretend that it's a 30 to 90 day bond and that it matures every 90 days. That means if you painted in the box that's left, that means as a taxpayer, instead of paying this, I'm paying that. So this is a wealth transfer from every from wealthy people to every municipality and every taxpayer, right? Because what they've done is eschew a higher interest that they could have earned to get the stable NAV from the money market fund, and the lesser interest they received was worth it to them in the trade-off for liquidity. That's just an extraordinary change in the market that tax-exempt money market funds caused. So with money market reform, one of the biggest groups of people who were complaining if they lost their ability to raise money were municipalities, because they depend upon tax-exempt money market funds to buy their instruments, to basically sell them to people like you and me who want tax-exempt income. And at the other end, again, we focused on what the SEC looks at, but the other end is the market. So the market was the treasurer in Montgomery County who was trying to buy five buses, and this is how he's going to do it. Mm-hmm. It's extraordinary that what we look at as an investment vehicle has huge implications in the market. It isn't just giving somebody money and watching them go buy Google for you. They're doing lots of things. Then that's really just remarkable.
So as part of the study in 78 of investment company of the 40 Act, you're putting more on the independent director, and that's something that increases through time, and ultimately the SEC, and particularly under Arthur Levitt, becomes very interested in increasing the responsibilities of the independent directors. What can you comment on as far as that and the SEC's rules in the mid-2000s on, how can I put it succinctly, making it so that the chair has to be an independent director in order to receive an exemption. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. So mutual funds by law have to have independent directors, and by law, at least 40% of them have to be independent. Mutual funds are different from any other vehicle, any other kind of entity that you've ever known about. They're not the same as foundations. They're not the same as universities. They're not the same as for-profit companies. Because everyone who works for a mutual fund lives and is employed by an entity that's not the mutual fund. The only people who get 1099s from the mutual fund are the independent directors. Everybody else works for somebody else. So all the relationships are there by contract. In a regular company, IBM, Microsoft, Google, whatever, it's a company that goes all the way up and there's a board of directors on top. And there's a clear distinction between being a director and being management, but there's this whole group of people who are employees. From the beginning, Congress got it that there's always a conflict between the investment advisor and the mutual fund. If you did it in law and economics terms, you'd say that the advisor wants to provide the worst investment performance possible for the greatest amount of money possible. If you were, again, from the same perspective, if you were looking at it as a director, you'd say, I want to pay the least amount of money possible for the best performance possible. Well, nobody really wants both of those extremes, and so that's why you end up with some bargaining that's in the middle. But their positions are literally adverse. If the directors overpay for advice, it's just money that's gone. If the investment advisor underperforms, he should be fired. But that's hard when Dreyfus is on the name of the fund or Schwab is on the name of the fund. So there's a huge difference between being an overseer and being a manager. And so what you've got is outside management in the investment advisor and inside directors. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yep.
Okay. So in the 78-81 era, we were trying to focus on the things where there was a real conflict. What directors can bring to the party is an ability to evaluate a conflict of interest. And if you if they are ill at ease at trying to figure out what standard they should apply, then it's easy for the SEC to say, well, the standard for that kind of conflict is fairness, or the standard for that kind of conflict is no overreaching on the part of any person concerned. You can impose standards like that that make it easy for directors to make decisions. And if they're wrong, it's just a business decision. They haven't done anything criminal. They may have made a mistake, but it's just a business decision. So we tried to stay away from things that had anything to do with management. So the release 10666 that imposes segregation requirements on assets in order to invest in derivatives doesn't have a word to say about directors in it. It's all an operational management responsibility, not a directorial responsibility. I'm not saying they don't have oversight, but they don't have anything to decide other than general oversight. And I thought that was a very clear distinction and a very rational one, given the mutual fund model. Whatever caused Leavitt and Donaldson to decide they needed more corporate governance, I don't know. That clearly, that's the era of mutual fund scandals in the early, it's right after Canary Capital and all the stuff in 2000 and 2005.
Although Leavitt was emphasizing this even before that.
Yes, that's all true and all fair. But it isn't true that at any point there haven't been you can count the number of cases that the SEC's brought against mutual fund directors on one hand, and they all involve personal overreaching or personal egregious behavior. They don't involve just bad business judgment. So it was a little hard to understand quite where Donaldson was going with the corporate governance rules. And I thought the evidence that the SEC had the statutory right to increase the requirement from the statutory 40% to 75% was thin, because Congress had thought about the idea of having more than 40% independent directors and had rejected it. And there wasn't anything except I'm unhappy with this that the SEC really had to point at. So I wasn't upset when the D.C. Circuit said that was a bad decision. I didn't think it was well documented, even if they had the statutory authority. And the others of the cases that the SEC brought in the 2000s, I thought were equally flawed in that they seemed to be working backwards. They seemed to have decided what the result was going to be and then tried to create cost-benefit or other analysis that would support it. Currently, the liquidity release and the derivatives release both give independent directors, and the pricing release give independent directors, an enormous amount of responsibility. And if you were my client as an independent director, I think I could look you in the eyes and say, I have no idea how you're supposed to satisfy that responsibility, and what exactly do you know about the markets that makes you personally capable of making that decision? If you say, I don't, but I hope you will, I'm in the same place you are. So I think that Matt Fink has written several articles about this recently, and he's right that we got to a fork in the road in 1978 and 81, and we did send the commission down the path of putting more things in the lap of the independent director. But they all had a conflict of interest element in it that was different from just supervising management decisions. To me, even with the mutual fund conflict structure, the external investment advisor structure, there ought to be something that's management's job and management's alone that's only the subject of oversight and not direct decision making.
In terms of the decision to contest the rule with on the basis of cost-benefit analysis? I mean, of course, this has been used in other areas as well. I mean, is that something that was particularly justified in this case, or do you think that it was just part of a general novel strategy that that has been used against the SEC, and it just happened to come in this particular against this particular rule?
Don't forget that there's a lot of people who can't win fights that they want to be involved in on the Hill. Mm-hmm. And one way you can win a fight that you can't win on the merits is to win the fight by switching it from the Hill, where there is no such thing as due process, to an administrative agency, but then tilt the scales on what is due process by making the cost and the benefit really, really hard to justify. So there aren't many other statutes. The securities laws are almost unique in that the mission that's given to the agency, of course, is to, you know, protect investors and get full disclosure, but it's also to make sure that we have better markets. And some of the decisions you have to make, it's very hard to explain why it would be that way. It's also really hard to explain it when Congress has told you you must do it. So if Congress has told you you must amend the 34 Act to require every issuer to explain whether or not they have anything to do with conflict minerals, they might as well ask them to explain if they've got anything, that company's got anything personally to do with climate change or global warming or slavery or anything else you could think of. Those are all interesting questions. They may be politically interesting questions, but from a securities lawyer purist perspective, what Congress has done is hijack the disclosure process to cause companies to have to make disclosures about things, whether or not they're uncomfortable, that have very little to do with the materiality of running their business. I can have all the sympathy in the world for someone who is trying to make sure they never touch a conflict mineral and think that that's just horrible, and I don't want to argue with them. But the disclosure process may not be the most effective law to get there. It's probably just the most embarrassing. And if you make it a requirement, then when a company fails to meet the requirement, whether or not it has anything to do with the business, whether it would have been a material fact but for Congress meddling in it, is pretty hard to explain that that's true. So in a lot of the cases that were brought against the division in the 2000s, the thing they wanted to do, let's take the insurance case just as an example. That commissioner decided right at the end of his tenure that when he was going to do something for seniors that was going to be memorable. So it was going to be stop this kind of fixed income annuity contract from being sold to seniors. And so and one way to do that is declare that it's a security. The consequence of that is that instead of having the insurance laws apply, the securities laws apply, including all the fraud provisions, but it also means that the insurer has to file a prospectus with the SEC. And you, the customer, now are going to have to look at a list of fixed income securities that's this long that supports the promise. I dare you to tell me that that's a meaningful disclosure to you, and having stared at that, you'll have any idea what you're doing. And so the way it got argued was that, of course, a prospectus would be better than no prospectus. Well, I suppose that's true. I don't know how you disprove it, but it's very hard to say that empirically because nobody tested whether it would be true, right? They didn't have some sort of focus group say, if you got a prospectus, would you be happier? There was no empirical proof. They just assumed the truth of it. So not surprisingly, the D.C. Circuit said that was not a cost analysis that they would defer to. So at this point, through their own processes, the SEC staff has gotten to a place where the D.C. Circuit's a very hostile environment to them. Partly they've gotten there because Congress has given them missions that cause them to have to make arguments that weren't going to be persuasive because they aren't legal arguments to a circuit court. And the cost-benefit stuff is very hard to prove. So if you've lost your case on the Hill, you didn't win, and you argued it before the agency, and you didn't win, then when you sue, you can win on cost benefit. So it's just, in many respects, it's sort of a travesty that it's given the person who lost all the substantive arguments just one more place to go. And that one more place is a place where the SEC hasn't done a good job of preventing him from winning the argument. Mm. But it's inside the agency, it's pretty clear that it's made it extremely hard to propose a rule to deal with a problem for fear that they'll get sued.
Is it possible to say anything, and this is a completely separate question, is it possible to say anything about the evolution of compliance within the mutual fund industry? I mean, traditionally it's considered to be an extremely clean industry. Then you have the late trading market timing scandals. Yep. So what happens in between within these companies that were they unable to keep up with their own growth? Were the compliance procedures not the same as they would be in other entities? It's a general question, I suppose.
And I don't have an empirical answer. I have an impression. My impression is that from the mid-90s till the market break in April of 2000, most of the mutual funds invested heavily in tech stocks. When the tech stocks and the dot-coms broke in April of 2000, and that market fell off by 40 or 50%, a lot of the mutual funds got hit. It cost them NAV. I mean, cost them net assets. Mm-hmm. Of course, it drove down the NAV from the standpoint of the investor. But losing assets also means that you lose revenue. So imagine what it would be like in a law firm if on the minute, 1 minute after April of 2000, you wake up and you say, okay, well, we've now lost 40% of our revenue. What exactly are we going to do next? Well, in a rational business, you'd fire 40% of the people because you can no longer feed them. What a number of the firms, particularly the sales load firms that had been heavily involved in technology, seemed to have decided was that they would put the pressure on the underwriters to just raise assets. And one of the ways it seems pretty clear that they decided to do it was to trade market timing access for money being invested, you know, in mutual funds. There was basically hot money that was just playing late prices. I think if you stuck a pin through all the firms that were involved and all the testimony and all the charges, you'd find that one common factor was usually that the investment advisor that got hurt during the market timing scandals was someone who had had a high emphasis on technology in their fund stocks, so they lost a lot of money. And they had to be sold with this, and they were being sold with a sales load. So it was very hard to sell something that was down dramatically with a sales load. So they needed something to create sales. I don't think the compliance environment changed. I think the economic environment changed, and that people were sort of willing to turn a blind eye to the economic reality of what they were asking their distribution guys to do. Certainly, it's true that since 2002. If you don't think compliance people aren't taking their job seriously, then you haven't talked to one lately. And in the last 2 years at least, the number of cases that have been brought by the SEC against compliance people personally has gone up, and it's probably fair to say that the allegations in most cases are tough in that the person did something, there something bad, wrong happened. The compliance person probably should have caught it. He may or may not have been complicit in it. And so there's an impression that the SEC is out to get the compliance guys. One way of evaluating that is the market salaries that compliance guys can command has almost doubled in the last 5 years. Because you have to pay someone quite a bit to be willing to take that amount of personal risk. On the other hand, even the most casual player in the mutual fund industry has probably doubled or tripled or quadrupled their compliance budget, and certainly the number of people involved. And with the board of directors constantly asking about compliance, if you were my client and you went to the regular quarterly board meeting of a mutual fund, more than half the time of the board meeting would be spent on some aspect of regulation or compliance. Not the business of being a mutual fund, but compliance. if you add cyber risk to that, it just is just one more thing that makes people fret and that there's very little they can do about it. I mean, the director's not personally going to be able to unplug something from the wall that will stop cybercrime from happening.
So we haven't talked about hedge funds, which have not traditionally been in quite the same regulatory area as mutual funds, but there's been movement in the past, you know, 15, 20 years to come to terms with that industry to at least a certain extent. I don't know what I can ask you from a general perspective about this, but perhaps you just have impressions on highlights that you might wish to discuss about the significance of that area.
Hedge funds and private equity basically weren't registered under the Advisors Act. The distributor wasn't registered under the Exchange Act. They weren't investment companies because they could rely on Section 3C1 to 3C7. And they rarely issued securities that would be described as a public offering. So if you were George Soros, and I don't mean him personally, but somebody like him, the only law that applied to you was basically the anti-fraud provisions of Rule 10b-5. There was virtually nothing else that did. So fairly or unfairly, it seemed very clear by 2008 that Congress was going to demonize hedge funds and make them be held responsible for the Great Recession. And we're going to make them register along with private equity funds. And then because they were going to take away Section 203b3 of the Advisors Act, there were a bunch of people who then would get caught. So in the language of Washington, they were, of course, unintended consequences. The goal was to get hedge fund advisors, not anybody else. At least that seems to be pretty clear. The venture capital guys correctly complained because there's nothing, if it really is venture capital, they're buying startups. It's very hard to see how there's anything systemic about what they do. You can say that Microsoft was once, that sort of seed company 25 years ago, but by the time it becomes Microsoft, the hedge fund hasn't owned it for the last 24 years, so that doesn't make any sense. Family offices were caught, and we represented the trade association that fought for an exemption for family offices. Venture capital and family offices were basically the only two exempted by Dodd-Frank. So one outcome from that was that if you had been, again, using George Soros only metaphorically, if you'd been George Soros and you'd come up with a brand new kind of fund in 2005 and you'd papered it and offered it and done all the other things you were supposed to, however you set that deal up, because of Dodd-Frank, you now had to register as an investment advisor. So when the SEC would come in and look at you in 2012, 2013, or 2014, they were looking at something you decided to do in 2005 or 6 or 7. And if you thought the only thing that you were subject to was the anti-fraud rules, you might not have been as tidy as you could have been in describing conflicts of interest, exactly how you're going to get paid, oversight fees that you would be charging portfolio companies, investment banking fees. So a lot of the crime wave that a casual reader of the newspaper would think has happened in the last 2 or 3 years in private equity funds and hedge funds is basically just criticizing people for decisions they made when they were subject to different laws in 2005, 2006, and 2007. So it ought to calm down. If you thought about hedge funds from an economic standpoint, so let's just think of them as always shorting. Mm-hmm. A law and economics guy would tell you in a nanosecond that the only way you can have a market that works is a willing buyer and a willing seller. So viewed from that perspective, a hedge fund is a good guy because he's helping with price discovery.
Okay, well, I don't have any more questions, but if you want to sum up or if there's anything that we haven't covered, by all means, do so.
Thank you for the privilege of being interviewed, and I am grateful to be able to contribute to the oral history of the SEC Historical Society. I'm a longtime donor and a longtime supporter and a personal friend of Carlo Rosati, and I think that the whole experiment is a good one. I've also been a personal contributor of documents to the historical, to the virtual library. It's a very good thing.
Well, thanks very much for your participation and adding to the oral history collections. I've certainly enjoyed working for the Historical Society and doing these interviews myself. So it's a real pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you.